in some of the podcasts I listen to, they record their talk, their chatter before the podcast the way we do. But instead of deleting it, they find some funny thing that somebody says, and then they use that as the lead-in. They play that even before the music. So do you have anything hilarious to say that we could use as a lead-in? Literature thrives on conflict and disorder, and in our last podcast, we asked whether this need for conflict and disorder has prevented many authors from writing good utopian fiction. But maybe there's more to be said on that subject. Do other kinds of fiction have utopian aspects? For example, do science fictions like Star Trek, with its federation of planets, multinational crew, and futuristic technology, offer a glimpse of utopia, even while they continue to provide us with compelling drama and action? I'm Alex Racy, and here with me, as always, to talk about this is John Farrell. Hey, John.
Alex, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
It's nice to be here.
Indeed.
Do you think we ought to fill in a little of the background for the people who might not have listened to the last podcast, because we're kind of segueing from that one into this one?
Sure, sure. Well, we were talking about a lecture that I had given about utopia and literature. I had made the point that literature is, as you said, mostly about disorder and chaos and problems. Even comedy, most of a comedy will be about the confusions and difficulties of the characters, and even though at the end things may be resolved in a way that's happy. And I had connected that general tendency to one of the main strains of literature, which was coming down to the Greeks from us, and that is epic literature. And my point was that the ideas about utopia, they largely emerged in a culture that was fed by literature, that the dominant way of thinking was literary. And it was a kind of literature that glorified the aristocratic culture of the time, the military aristocratic culture. And so it's all about killing and warfare. Life is thought of as short, and the only way of living beyond your life is by being known as a famous great hero. So other people's ideas about you, reputation, honor, recognition, those are the central values of that culture. And poetry, of course, exists to elevate those great people.
And the utopian fiction is a reaction to this.
Yes.
And tries to create a world without that kind of conflict and competition and disorder.
A world that has been arranged to avoid the inequality that's the basis of heroic culture. So communism is a common element in those utopian systems. You see that in Plato. Now, Plato's world still has ranks. In later Greek culture, you have Cynics and Stoics and others saying that it's enough to live according to nature. And they all have different ideas of what that entails. Not all of them want to leave the ordinary world, but they all engage in a kind of critique of human need, which would tell you that being famous, being heroic, being better than other people is not the key to the good life. And then Thomas More, we talked about him and his scheme for utopia, which was stimulated by the discovery of the New World, or so-called, opening up of the old world to the so-called new. And one of the first notions of what the New World was like was that it was full of people living according to nature, living without European inequality, luxury, softness, frivolity, and so on. And that seemed like an inspiration for possibly a new kind of life. And so More imagines that. And he couples that with a very trenchant critique of his present society, which is aristocratic and also economically exploitative for the rich. It's basically a conspiracy of the rich against the poor. So that's the charm of imagining this utopian world where there's no property, no display, no ranks or status. Everyone is living together, and the main point of life is really almost being a philosopher. The main point of life is learning, study, sharing wisdom, rather than competing for honor or wealth.
And one of the worries that we had was that utopian fiction that describes that sort of place, although, who knows, maybe it's a good idea, morally speaking,
yes,
it's a boring place and makes for bad fiction.
And that leads to a bigger worry, which is if literature is an activity that deliberately caters to our dreams and gratifies our nature, and if a society without inequality is unappealing, that it may be simply unappealing to our psychology entirely, beyond literature. And that's certainly one way of thinking about what you see in our culture now. You have massive inequality and people are acquiring money they can't even spend on themselves, while many other people have so little. And it even raises the question of, is happiness itself a zero-sum game? Are we not satisfied with being well-off in any absolute terms, unless we're also better off than somebody else?
And then the question I asked you was, all right, so is there fiction which somehow provides a more realistic picture of utopia?
Yes.
One which is not boring and perhaps even incompatible with human nature? And one or the other of us, I can't remember who mentioned it first, said something like, well, you know, how about Star Trek, the world of Star Trek? You know, it's a kind of utopia, people living together in a certain kind of harmony and doing this noble thing of exploring the universe, and yet they seem to manage to have a certain amount of conflict and not to be totally unrealistic. And what's great is that then after we finished that podcast, you told me that you thought that that example was perhaps more interesting than we noticed at the time. And you wanted
yes.
to do a podcast where we pick up from there. So this is dramatic for me because usually I have some idea about what we're podcasting about. But today I don't. All I know is that you were intrigued by the Star Trek comment and here we go. So, okay. What was so intriguing about the Star Trek idea?
Well, it really got me thinking about how shows like that work. Star Trek is successful popular entertainment. So we can't say that whatever utopian qualities it has make it uninteresting. If it has a utopian element, then that seems to call into question the thesis that we were entertaining, which is that utopia must be boring. So the first thing that came to mind is I might want to talk a little bit about the way people have used the word utopia in criticism. Literary critics are finding utopian elements in literature all the time. And it's especially popular among Marxists, including very famous ones like Ernst Bloch, who wrote a famous book on hope, and Frederick Jameson, who's probably the most well-respected contemporary Marxist literary critic. And the way they write about utopia is they tend to see everything in dialectical terms, in Marxian dialectical terms, which means that everything is terrible and wonderful at the same time. So you see, when you read literary works of whatever moment, they are products of capitalism, and they show the way that capitalism confines the intellect in a way that is reinforcing of social confinements and oppression of various kinds. But on the other hand, you always also see sparks of how things could be better. You see utopian glimmers of one kind or another.
Is there an example of that you can give us? I mean, is there a book maybe a lot of people have read and we can do a kind of fake Marxist interpretation where they're simultaneously seeing elements of oppression and elements of hope? I mean, is this a game we can play with any literary work? Can we do it with To Kill a Mockingbird or The Great Gatsby? Or
well, all right, so To Kill a Mockingbird, let's just pick one and go with it.
Okay.
You know, actually, To Kill a Mockingbird, we almost have to do three steps on that one because it has a kind of progressivist hopefulness, which a Marxist critic would see as an idealization and as an ideological idealization of American society, that you have this fellow Atticus Finch, who is a good man, and even though he shares many of the social attitudes, which Harper Lee finds somewhat questionable in some ways, he nevertheless believes fundamentally in justice, and so he helps a black man in his case.
Right.
A Marxist critic would have to say, no, that's not right. That is not utopian. Because that is a glamorization of America.
I see. So the people who write that story are people who've somehow falsely bought into the narrative of, what, America is a place of justice or something.
Yes.
So that's finding the non-utopian, the
yes.
oppressive aspects,
yes.
paradoxically, in the positive side of the story.
So where would a Marxist look for the utopian element? It would have to be something that was almost unthought or unthinkable. Something strange and unassimilable. You know, maybe Boo Radley. Boo Radley, the strange child who never comes out, but he winds up saving Scout and the other child at a certain point in the story.
So he's the oppressed person who nonetheless still has a good egalitarian heart and what represents hope for living together in harmony or something?
Yes, and he wouldn't have to even have intentions or thoughts like that, but he'd be this kind of incomprehensible other that remains somehow part of the experience of the text. So it can't all be ascribed to either capitalist oppression or a phony idealization.
Right.
That's how that kind of reading would work.
Okay.
And I'm making this up. It's totally phony, but you're getting the idea.
Yeah.
You find something, the French have a word, impensée. It's not thought. It's this thing beyond the system. And that could be hopeful. And Ernst Bloch could find utopian elements in anything. Jazz music is utopian.
Because of the freedom
Yes.
Where people are playing and not being confined, at least in certain forms of jazz, to musical convention or something like that.
And really, I think part of the idea is that literature and culture in general provide you with an experience of satisfaction that is utopian, because it gives you a standard for what you could expect from life. When you read literature, you get this joy that is produced by shared consciousness, and that kind of sharing and that kind of intensity might give you a sense that, you know, life should be more like this. You should be able to go from that into the world. So that's one way of talking about utopia.
Mm-hmm.
I don't find that very helpful for Star Trek, because although it is all about contacting new species and stuff like that, communicating with creatures that have no heads, whatever, you know. Silicon-based.
No, the terrible thing about Star Trek is they all had human heads, but they just had weird little prostheses stuck to their foreheads. That was a sign you were from another planet. But anyway, I get your point.
Or, you know, silicon-based life.
Yeah.
Things like that. So that's one way of the critics have talked about utopia. But then there is progressive utopianism of the kind that Oscar Wilde can be taken as an example of. He said famously that a map of the world that does not include utopia is not worth glancing at, because utopia is it's where progressive reforms are imagined. We're always setting out to a new one, and progress is the realization of utopias.
So no matter how far we get, there's always some farther utopia that we should be imagining.
Yes. And I think Star Trek actually has the utopian element of that kind, because you have the crew of Star Trek, which at the time was just very evident that you have Russian and the Japanese and African woman and the Vulcan, who's non-human. So it was an early example of exemplary diversity.
Right. So that crew already constituted maybe what the viewers would have thought as a utopia. And yet your idea is that within that show, which is itself a kind of utopia, they're setting off to look for something even more utopian? Is that the idea?
To me, the other thing I was going to say about it is that actually the show is an example of the heroic, because you have this utopian, the idea of the already achieved utopia on Earth, universal peace. There's the United Federation of Planets, which is the organization that has launched the Starship Enterprise out into the galaxy. And apparently from the composition of the show, that there has been a truly peaceful union of human beings and people from other planets, and marvelous technology allowing you to go past light speed and so on, warp speed. And so the premise, it starts with the utopia. And as I remember, there's also the prime directive.
Right.
Which is a rule they follow before all others, which is they cannot interfere with the cultural development of the worlds they visit. So that is an attempt, I think, to preclude any analogy between the United Federation and the colonial enterprise.
Right.
They let every country develop its own culture. You can also see that as a classically liberal ideology, almost a Wilsonian way of thinking. So that's the premise of the story, right? But then we're still heroes out there going to fight the Romulans.
Yeah.
And the Klingons. So the basic story is same old story of us versus them war.
I see. So this isn't an Oscar Wilde utopia where we're setting out for another utopia. You think the way the show works as a kind of utopian story is that we've established utopia somewhere else on Earth, but now we just reinvent the heroic epic. We create people to fight and all these conflicts, and that's what gives the show interest.
Yes. So it's a mixed show. It's a mixed form. You have the utopia as the basis, but the actual story is about conflict and problems. And then I started thinking about Mr. Spock. And Mr. Spock is actually a classic utopian character in the sense that he is the one who acts entirely through reason. And he is actually regarded skeptically by the other members of the crew because he lacks emotion or he denies emotion. And it's actually the captain who's the idol of the show. And he's a more classically heroic character who acts according to his emotions and so on rather than reason. And so that all feeds back into the heroic formula. So you were right, I think, though, that space and the ability to invent imaginary enemies, which is painless to be against. It's easy to invent Romulans and Klingons and be against them. That's a nice formula for taking a utopian basis and then re-energizing it with heroic energies.
And there may even be an element here that we haven't mentioned, which is I think there was always some idea that even though they were in conflict with the Romulans and the Klingons and so on. The idea was that one day they would live in peace with them. They were actually hoping for that.
Yes.
So it's certainly not a complete throwback to warrior culture, where ultimate success was defeat of your enemies. Ultimate success was still furthering utopia and living in peace with these other races, which is, I think, in later Star Trek incarnations, they did. So eventually the Klingons, I think, are shown as being, I'm going to get this wrong, but something like part of the Federation of Planets. At any rate, they're on the Enterprise. There's a Klingon on the Enterprise in later shows.
In epic writing, unlike some other forms, some more classic adventure tale stories, the opponents are not necessarily evil. The Trojans are not evil, or very different from the Greeks. That's a part of classic epic storytelling, that your opponents are worthy and honorable even though you aim to defeat them. And another thing I'm reminded of is that even up through the 1960s, and the Star Trek is, I guess, starting in the mid-60s,
I believe. Think that's right, yeah.
Yes. You know, war is still thought of as the grand idealistic enterprise and place when people sacrifice their lives for their country and so on. It's only very recently that has become less of a presence in American culture. So, and Star Trek plays into that very, very strongly.
You know, a strange thing is that even if we've now figured out how Star Trek is able to pull off being utopian fiction and also interesting, which is basically by just reintroducing conflict, it doesn't solve, though, the other problem that we had, which is that we were not only puzzled about how you could make utopian fiction interesting as fiction. There was the second problem, which is that maybe we learned something about the impossibility of utopia from the fact that it's boring literature. The way these two things are connected is it's boring literature because it has no conflict and is also in some way or other unrealistic because human nature deeply requires or seeks conflict. And Star Trek doesn't take away that sort of grim message, because essentially what it would say is the only way this utopia is going to exist is, you know, if you give human beings some other outlet for this competition and conflict that they crave, right?
Yes.
I mean, I suppose it's a little more optimistic like that, because it does say that at least part of your society can be utopian, the Federation of Planets, as you say. But it sort of sends the message that human beings will always look for, in some way or other, these conflicts to fight.
You know, another angle on the subject is that the best way to show something great is to show it in the process of destruction. And in some ways, the tragedy is actually the most idealizing kind of story. Because you can more convincingly show really good people if the point of the story is that really good people are being destroyed. There's something very deeply sad about seeing Hamlet, for instance, undergo his demise. Because there's a sense of his great intelligence and the feeling that people have for him, which is only a deep background element. But it makes you feel the painfulness of seeing him destroyed. So perhaps there's really more utopian or more convincing idealization in seeing things destroyed than there is in seeing very good things presented in a way that shows them as flourishing.
But I don't know if is that showing utopia? I mean, I've always had the feelings you just described. So I feel that part of the reason why I'm attracted to sad stories or tragic stories is that they reaffirm for me the value of human life and the importance of many things. Because
yes,
the reason you feel sad or the reason you sense something to be a tragedy is that you sense that something of value has been lost, right? So it does remind you of the value of things. But it's not utopian, because what it shows you is those valuable things being destroyed, right?
Right. Well, it would become utopian in that Marxist way that I was talking about and sort of making fun of, which is that it does make you feel there is something of value, as you say. And showing it destroyed is the best way of showing its reality, its value. In Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, there's a character who is different from everybody else in the story because he grew up outside the world state. And the world state is this utopian realm from which all discomfort and pain and instability and drama have been removed. So everyone is nicely drugged all the time. Everyone is required to have sex with everyone else, more or less. There's a kind of compulsory promiscuity. People have been produced in test tubes. So they have no parents to inherit, from whom they can inherit neuroses. So life is just one long kind of orgy party. And the one character who grows up outside that system, he feels an absolute lack of anything of true value. And one thing he says is, nothing here costs enough, that there's no need for sacrifice of any kind. So he has that reaction that we were talking about last time with regard to Moore, that, you know, you've removed all the magnificence for life. The administrator tells him, the guy who runs the world state in Brave New World tells him that happiness is boring. Happiness is not grand. You want something heroic, and what you're saying is you want right to be unhappy. And that's the impasse. There's a sense of loss of a sense of loss.
Right.
It's a weird paradox. What he says is he misses love, God, truth, heroism, the grand things, right? And what he sees is a world of complete banality. And so there's always, obviously, even in the heroic world, they don't just say we want to be better than other people per se. They're talking about the value of being remembered, which they think of as a real thing, and admiration in the eyes of the gods and being in the poem. So they don't, I think it's a somewhat reductive attitude that I took towards it in regarding it as an appetite for inequality per se. And perhaps I refine that a bit. You know, even in the Iliad, I don't think that the joys of the home life have ever been portrayed more attractively than from the point of view of everything that's being destroyed in the war. There's a great Achilles description of Achilles' shield, which has basically all of life displayed on it, the good and the bad. It's very beautiful, and it makes you feel the greatness of life. There's a great moment when Achilles is chasing Hector around the walls of Troy, and Hector's running for his life. And Homer mentions that they pass by the washing fields, washing pools, where the women go out to wash the clothing in peacetime. And that really tugs your heart when you read that. So I agree with you that it's nostalgia for things that are really of value. Do we value them when we don't have to struggle for them? We have to compete for them. That becomes the question.